Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
There's a moment in Alexandria Baumbach's documentary about the Indigo Girls that tells you a lot about them as people, if not a band. The Indigo Girls, if you don't know, though you probably do, is a folk rock duo, or at least they're labeled as a folk rock duo. And it's Amy Ray and Emily Saliers. They've been together for more than 40 years now. And you can see in the film how they've had to wrestle with not just remarkable fame and popularity that they weren't always sure they wanted, but also being a cultural cliche or punchline, the impression that their music is overly earnest or precious. Amy and Emily are pretty introspective about all of this and about their music and their lives, and they resist being too self-centered in their work. And the moment in the film is early in the story. Amy was in college in Nashville, and she wrote this song that has this white-hot intensity to it. It's called Blood and Fire. Here's the director, Alexandria Baumbach.
And it was a difficult time for Amy because she didn't feel connected in Nashville to a community and was going through a lot of internalized homophobia because she was, you know, facing a lot of homophobia.
And I was very, like, lonely and depressed. I was having trouble in my relationship because it was so pressured by just us being gay, and she couldn't really come to terms with the gayness, and I could, and it just, there was so much shame around it. That was like the discovery of shame. I hated my body. I hated myself. It was just a self-loathing time.
And so this song comes out of Amy that is so powerful and so beloved, but it really taps into the pain that she was feeling at that time and that she was very absorbed in. And, you know, it was a song that I hadn't really explored that much in, you know, listening to their music before making this film, and really fell in love with it. So when I asked her about it and she goffed and was like, one of my least favorite songs, I was super shocked and also very interested in why that would be.
You know, I mean, I wrote that in like the midst of like deep depression and self-destructive, like literally cutting myself and, you know, literally doing all that. But when I sing it now, I think, oh my God, this is so narcissistic. Like, is it, it's not all about you.
You know, for her, it just felt very self-centered and all about herself versus, you know, reaching out.
One thing that can heal you is to reach outside of yourself. I know you got to put your own air mask on first. I get that sentiment, but I don't always agree with it. I don't really want to put my gas mask on first. I want to help somebody. You know, and I get the sentiment, you got to be whole to help and you got to heal yourself and all that. But the healing for me is in the ability to reach out to somebody else and empathize with them and be in the same boat together. That's the healing. How many other people were in the same kind of pain that I didn't even notice because I was so wrapped up in my own?
It's very indicative of, you know, how Amy goes about the world right now and wants to be in the world is by reaching out and not making things about herself. So there's an embarrassment of this past self in the song that she wrote, but there's still true feelings that she has of you know, that pain and passion and anger and all things that still live inside of her. But now she just approaches the world in a completely different way. And I thought it was an interesting look into, you know, the process of writing a song and how your process changes over time. How long till my soul gets it right? And it also is a big reflection of who we are over time and how we don't change and how we do change. And a lot of this film is about that change and how we navigate, you know, our lives artistically, but also internally. That's all I've got to say.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the documentary film Indigo Girls, It's Only Life After All. This is the latest in our documentary film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening it this weekend on Saturday. We'll give you some details here in a bit. Early on in the film, the director, Alexandria Baumbach, asks the Indigo Girls, Amy Ray and Emily Saliers, one of those questions you'd think would be self-evident, but with these two in this film, it's just not. She asked them, what is this documentary about?
I asked them what it was about because I wanted audiences to understand that they were going to narrate their own lives, that they were going to give us so much and tell us so much about their lives, but they weren't going to have control of the edit of the film.
So I don't know what it's about. I mean, our hope was that it could be about something besides just us.
This one is a song about liberation. There's so much more to us that happens off the stage that tells our story.
We're supposed to be somewhere where we're not.
Yeah.
The important part of what we have experienced is more about activism and actions and just how you affect the people around you.
And so they were very trusting and gave me full control over it at all. And so I wanted them to be like, we're going to tell you all this stuff, but we don't know what the film's about, you know, and we're trusting you to put it together. And I think that trust comes up multiple times in the film in subtle ways. The film opens with a photographer they're working with, and they just trust Jeremy to do what he does. And the film ends with a makeup artist, and Emily even says, like, I trust you. You know, it's the Indigo Girls. They've always been authentically themselves and done things very differently. And I wanted this film to reflect that.
One of the things that the film raises is how they fit in the music scene, the Indigo Girls, and like whether they fit in, you know, the folk music scene. I mean, they were more interested in alternative music or even punk music, they say, which was interesting. Even though, of course, they do have a folk sound or a folk sensibility. So how do you think and where do they situate themselves? It doesn't seem like they care exactly where, but what do you think about the way they think about where they fit?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think for me, and you know, even for one of my story consultants I was working with, West, they're you know, a decade younger than me. We were both really reminded of that, and kind of, you know, fascinated by that people were so obsessed with genre in the 90s and yeah. You know. And the aughts, but it, you know, it's just not as, I don't think it's as much as a thing now to like really put a finger on something like that as it was back then, but it still exists obviously. But you know, they're, what's so cool about them is that like if you listen to some of their albums, it feels like song to song they're different genres.
Yeah.
Which I love, and you know, they're before their time with that, because I don't think people really were doing that back then and didn't want to stray because of marketing or whatever, or audience. But now, you know, you have Beyonce making country albums. And so it's like,
yeah.
you know, it's what you're into at the time and how you a certain song feels best is probably, I think, what they would say. But yeah, I don't even know if I could define their music. Maybe folk and maybe rock and maybe punk and maybe pop. I think it's all in there.
Yeah. How do you describe their process, the Indigo Girls, their the process that they have of making, let's just say just music. We'll get to their kind of really interesting relationship here in a second. But how, what have you learned about their process? Because we see in the film, in one case, Emily says it's Amy who's the vision for the band. And then you hear Amy talking about Emily as really the her skill anyway as a songwriter. And a lot of her songs are the hits. And so how do you describe the who does what and the kind of process for the two? Do you think you've learned that in making the film?
Yeah, I don't know if I could speak to it fully, but what I do know, you know, they write separately.
Yeah.
And, you know, songs are typically either an Amy song or an Emily song, but they have so much collaboration when they actually are putting it together in the studio and they're helping each other out and making suggestions and working with a producer, obviously. And so it becomes more collaborative towards the end, but the writing process is typically just they're off by themselves. You know, Emily is the kind of writer, I guess, where she needs to be completely alone and in quiet. And Amy's the kind of writer where she wants to be in like a loud cafe or around a bunch of people. And
right.
Which I love that fact. And I don't know much about music, but what is cool about that to me is that it really reflects their personalities in some ways, you know, introvert versus extrovert. I love that aspect of it.
How do you describe their relationship? Emily says they're two very different people. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I think they're very different people. You know, I don't think I could do justice to describing their relationship. I think, you know, I communicate through film with that kind of stuff, and that's as best as I can do. And I love how it comes across in the film. But I don't know if I could speak to it in the same way because it's sensitive, right? It's two people in a very unique situation where they've known each other since elementary school and they've been so close over the years and intertwined in ways that very few people could understand and very few people make it through, you know? Like, that's many, many years together as a band. And it's just a phenomenon and fascinating and I still feel protective and I feel like it's private to even talk about our relationship in some ways, but what I convey in the film is definitely how it feels. And I think they felt that it portrayed that well.
Well, let me ask the question a better way then, because I think that's right. Like, how can you answer that question? Let me ask you then the way the relationship is conveyed in the film, what you noticed with the way they, you know, we learn about when they meet, they sort of connect in Atlanta, and they're friends. And there's this obsession that they talk about in the part of the film where they address the question of whether they're together in a relationship or whether they dated.
Why do you think that people think that you're dating or have dated each other?
Probably just because we're two queer women and, of course, we must have dated each other.
No, we've never dated. We've never wanted to date.
There's never been an inkling. It's like a chemical compound that won't compound.
We're both gay. And
the film gets at this, so I won't ask you to just speculate on their personal feelings, but it does seem like when they're talking in the film, like when you hear clips from their rehearsal tapes in high school, which we hear, which is awesome. Emily writes a song for Amy. Amy says that she was blinded by her love for Emily. Like, what do you figure they were getting at there? What are they expressing there? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I relate to that in such a big way. I think what they're expressing is queer platonic love.
Huh.
And I definitely have that in friendships and where you have this deep love, but it's completely platonic and driven sometimes by a passion like music, which is also a love in your life. And I, you know, wanted to address early that they had never dated, because when I started making the film and, you know, people ask you, oh, what are you working on next? And I'm like, I'm making a film about the Indigo Girls. It was always the first question.
Yeah. Huh.
Like, did they ever date? And I didn't even think about that, because I don't know why, but I never thought that about them. But yeah, it's also just like a thing that people think about lesbians, that they, of course they dated each other. And I love addressing that fully with Amy and Emily in the film, and like what that means. And they laugh about it. And it's a funny part of the film, but also kind of like, yeah, what is that like immediate assumption? But their relationship, I think, is such a big part of what the film explores. And I think it is a chosen family, queer, platonic romance that evolves over time and shifts and changes and has deep impacts on their lives. So yeah, I've been really grateful that a lot of queer people especially really relate with that kind of friendship and the way that story's told.
Emily says, Amy is at the center of me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can imagine how big of a role they've both played in each other's lives. And like, you have this other person that looms so large, and everything you've ever done, you compare yourself to the other one.
Yeah.
And there's so much beauty and strength to that, and hard things to that as well. And it all comes to a head at the end of the film, and I won't give it away. But yeah, that is one thing that Emily really reflects on. And it was really interesting showing the film to them the first times. They were kind of just processing it at first. But when they saw it again at Sundance, Emily had the reflection that, you know, it made her love Amy even more. Hmm. I think films are very interesting, and making a film about someone is just such a bizarre thing to do to someone's life, because you're encapsulating their story and then showing it back to them. I was really grateful and blown away that, you know, Emily's reaction was like, I just, seeing that all put together, it just makes me love her even more.
That's Alexandria Baumbach talking about their film Indigo Girls, It's Only Life After All. This is the latest in our Through the Lens series. We're going to be screening it on Saturday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Our documentary film series is back from a summer break, so today in the program, we're profiling a film about the Indigo Girls, Amy Ray and Emily Saliers. This is a departure from the formula of musical biopics. It's called It's Only Life After All. It premiered at Sundance this year, and we're going to be screening it this weekend. We'll give you more details about that in a moment. We have with us today the director, Alexandria Baumbach. What do you make of the question that we see in the film Charlie Rose ask, which is something like, how much is your sexuality, is the fact that you're lesbians, how much does that affect, I don't know, your music?
The fact that you're both lesbians, but not together, so to speak, in a romantic way. Do people care about that? Do they know about it? Is it part of the appeal? Does it have any impact at all on your life and your music?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's the impact has changed through time, how it impacts us, but we get...
What do you make of that question? Because one of the things I did wonder, like, how much of this... their work. How much of it is, you know, a queer thing? How much of it is just a kind of creative chemistry? What do you make of that, I guess, that question?
Well, you know, that Charlie Rose interview was doing some heavy lifting and served a lot of purpose very early in the film because, you know, Charlie Rose, who has now been outed to be a pretty creepy character, asking this question in the early 2000s about queerness that is just so off-putting and then continues to interrupt them throughout the whole interview. And then Amy lands it with, like, you know, it's also sexism and it's also the fact that we're activists.
Women who are outspoken and sort of earnest for rock critics, that's a hard one. You know, they can't get their head around it. They can understand Rage Against the Machine, but they don't understand the Indigo Girls.
I think their connection musically comes from so many different places. Yeah. Like, you know, Amy is a very, in my opinion, like a very, has a lot of dark or energy. And I mean, this is a cliche and a trope that they've been fighting against, so I feel bad saying this, but, you know, Emily has a lot of lighter energy. They are just very opposite from each other, and that harmony exists for a reason. And that's what people really fell in love with in the beginning and still love so much. And also their values and what they wanted to live by in their lives was a huge reason for them sticking together. You know, the many, many years of activism work that they've done.
Yeah.
And that being such a driving force of so many of the songs too.
Here's a kind of a process question. I think the impact of that music is so connected to the lyrics. How do you do that in a documentary? Like, how do you make that work as you're playing, you know, and because then you have also them talking about it. And like, how do you make that part work? Surely you thought about that part.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're tapping into the reason I would like cry myself to sleep at night. It was like, it was probably one of the hardest parts of this was the lyrics. And it was like a total puzzle to solve where the lyrics mean stuff, but they're also talking. And I can't make this film 5 hours long.
Yeah.
As much as I don't even think the fans would care if it was. But, you know, it was a struggle to figure out that balance. And I decided that what was more important is that people heard from them and they were inspired to listen to the music afterwards, which I think is maybe a hot take as far as music biopics go. And I didn't want to get into process. And, you know, there's other music biopics that do that and, you know, explain in didactic and lengthy detail how every song is written or how every album came about. And I just, you know, I just, you know, ultimately I had to make a movie that I liked, and I I don't like those movies, other movies. So I wanted to hear from them ultimately, which is really cool because people have in like when we were doing theatrical or film festivals, or I've heard it even when people are watching this film on Netflix now, that they'll have big dance in their living room parties or actual parties where people will have listening parties. And so that is happening outside of the medium of film, which I think was kind of the goal.
So we learn in the film, you know, these really deeper things about their characters. And I wanted to ask you about a few of these. I wanted to start with Amy. There's this moment where they're playing. It's a rehearsal or something, maybe a video that they're shooting or something. They're being filmed, and a string breaks on Amy's guitar. Feathered arms and a key to heaven's gate.
Sorry. My default, unfortunately, has been anger or distrust.
You kind of explore this sense of anger that she has and this sense of distrust. Will you talk a little bit about that part of the story?
You know, in interviewing Amy and talking with Amy over the, you know, months of filming her, it came up a couple times outside of the interview that, you know, she definitely had a temper and still struggles with it internally, but is nowhere near that anymore. And I was just very interested, you know, I didn't want this film to just be the, you know, polished, you know, because that's not them, you know, this polished film about their lives or just puff piece. And they were so willing and wanting to go over this stuff. And I was really appreciative of Amy talking about that, because I think it's really relatable, and especially when you're a passionate person and you're just dealing with so much sexism in an industry. And I deal with this. I dealt with it yesterday. I screened a film at a theater here in Santa Fe, and one of the projectionists was incredibly rude to me when I said the projection wasn't coming out right. And it was just, and I was being talked to as if I was a child. And I was like, I know you're not talking to the men like this. I know you're not. And it's just something that is so infuriating. And, you know, I think it's a massive conversation within activism, you know, that the helpfulness of rage against oppression. And what I love about that scene is, you know, we see Amy have this temper tantrum, but then we also see Emily connect in another interview that, like, it's hard for her to speak out sometimes, and that she's really grateful for Amy for helping her with that. And I feel that with my friends, you know, I am not conflict averse. I am very willing to stand up and speak. And sometimes that makes me feel ridiculous and like I'm too much or something like that. But really, I think there's just a lot of reasons why that can be very helpful for others around you, is like having that passion inside. But it definitely needs to be just controlled, I think, and figured out. Maybe not controlled, but figured out, because you can be a little shit in your young years. And I think Amy would agree with that.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that's sort of how Emily is different in that way. And that's the other sort of character study I wanted to ask you about. She admits, look, we went into this to be, you know, musicians, rock stars, I guess. And even though she said, I chose this career, I don't like being observed. And this comes up in the question of that they asked themselves early in their career, should we come out publicly? And Emily wasn't willing to necessarily talk about it, be public about this at first. Talk about this part of Emily's character that we learn in the film.
Yeah, I'm exploring that with her in an interview and in the film, because it's still, you know, something that is talked about and debated within the queer community. I mean, at that point when they came out, I mean, this was a time when Elton John was saying that he was bi. Yeah. You know, Ellen wouldn't have come out for another 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, this was early days, and there were a lot of people who were being outed, like famous people who were being outed, and which is so like abrasive. I don't know. It can be very awful to do to someone. But, you know, it's just different times and different strategies and frustrations and that rage, you know, of oppression. But, you know, Emily didn't really get into this with the full understanding of, you know, becoming, although she enjoyed so much of it and was joyful, I think there was a really difficult part of the intrusiveness into her life that just was not something that she could handle well, and ends up having a big impact on her later in the film that you see. But, you know, I think it's that parasocial relationship, you know, that the thing that audience or fans think that they own the person that they're a fan of, or that they are somehow have rights to their inner lives.
Yeah.
You know, Chapel Roan is really talking a lot about this now, and I think very bravely. And, you know, that's, you know, we've we've gone over what we did to Britney Spears. We've gone over, like,
know, what happens to Amy Winehouse and Whitney Houston and the pressure and the erasure of queerness in those pressures. You know, it was Emily resisted, but I wish this would have come across. She resisted in comparison with Amy, but, you know, in comparison with society at that time, it was incredibly brave. Incredibly brave. You know, talk about comparison again. It was hard to convey all of that without, and this was the hard part. You know, I didn't have an interview with Elton John talking about this, or he would have just stated it clearly, maybe. But I was working within the constraints of the form of just having them tell their own stories. And, you know, at the time, it just, it was incredible that they came out. And I think Emily, after experiencing a violent attack for being queer in a bar when she was young, around that time, I think it just stilled her for the importance of it all. And it, but it was just so much fear, and which was incredibly valid.
I think an important part of the film is raises this issue of self-homophobia. And we see how Amy and Emily deal with becoming a caricature, basically, becoming kind of a punchline. I mean, we see them being made fun of on Saturday Night Live.
And the amount of time it took to do that introduction, 1,000 women were emotionally assaulted by their spouse or domestic partner. Find out more at www.shamepolicemybodyismyowntakeupthefight.org.
If you guys had asked us to play on Saturday Night Live and then you made fun of us, that would be okay.
The issue that they're not cool. And, you know, look, they have both of them have really healthy senses of humor. They sort of get it. But this stuff hurt their feelings. The idea that, you know, lesbians are odd and inattractive. There's this scene from an episode of Ellen.
God, it's just great. Everybody doing their own thing out in public. Nobody's afraid of being stared at or judged. Oh, my God, look at those freaks.
Say something about this part.
Yeah, pulling back, when I said when I was catching up with people and be like, what do you next? And I would say the Indigo Girls, I would get one of two reactions. One with either, oh my God, I love the Indigo Girls, or like kind of a snicker and being like, oh, I don't like their music, or like, I don't like their music. I don't know anything about them, but kind of a laugh. And I'm like, do you know where that comes from? And that because they were kind of put into this weird world of being made fun of. And it wasn't just because they were queer, because, you know, Ellen was, I mean, she also had a difficult time, her show being canceled and all those things. But there was a certain, like Melissa Etheridge, there was a certain way you could be queer. And, you know, it's even happening today, too, with like, you know, there's a certain way that you could be gender nonconforming. There's a certain way that you can present as a queer person in the music industry, like Brandi Carlile. And but they were also, you know, not hyper feminine or and there was, you know, a lot of pushback of them being activists. It was not cool to be an activist. And that was the majority of what they were made fun of for on Saturday Night Live. But in the film, you know, I really wanted to take this into consideration, people's assumptions and preconceived notions of who they were, because we were coming in with a lot. You know, it wasn't making a film about like the Sparks Brothers or something. It was, there was a lot of people's background information in their heads of what they knew about the Indigo Girls. And so I started the film with a lot of humor, and then where they are the ones making you laugh. And you know, it was amazing in audiences, in theaters, seeing, like hearing that laughter explode. And by the end of the film, you're talking about humor and this laughter. And I just, I wanted them to have power over that emotion of laughter. And so I gave them that power in the beginning. And these are all subtle things, but I think they do something to someone in an audience if they're engaged with the film. And that, I think that whole time period, you know, is the same time period of Britney Spears, is the same time period where it was just, you know, I was in high school. It was not a great time for feminism or queerness or activism, you know. It was a big pendulum swing after the 90s. And I think we're dealing with a similar pendulum swing now. That's really scary. And so even though this is a story in the past that evolves, it's also something I want people to consider today, especially around gender queerness.
Alexandria Baumbach, we're talking about their film Indigo Girls, It's Only Life After All. This is the latest in our Through the Lens series with the Utah Film Center. We usually do these screenings on weeknights. This time, we're showing the film on Saturday as part of the Utah Queer Film Festival. We'll be at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. You can get more details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling Alexandria Baumbach's film about the Indigo Girls, Amy Ray and Emily Saliers. Baumbach makes use of Amy's extensive cache of old cassettes and videotapes to create this portrait of two queer women who have been making music for more than 40 years while contending with stereotypes and condescension and their own personal demons. The film is called Indigo Girls, It's Only Life After All. We're going to be screening it this weekend. Back now to our conversation with Alexandria Baumbach. There's a section I want to ask you about that I loved in the film, and it's the section where you have them read a review from the New York Times from John Perellis, the music critic there. It was a pretty cutting piece.
Earnest pretentiousness has new standard bearers, the Indigo Girls.
Their music revives the strummed acoustic guitars and close harmonies of early 1970s arty confessional songwriters. You can hear him being derogatory, right?
And their lyrics push obscurity and preciousness towards hyperbole. Oh, great journalism right there.
They can harmonize to gorgeous effect. So that was complimentary. Each Indigo Girl has a slightly different style of pretension. Yeah, see, that's why it pissed me off. Would it piss you off if you read this?
What a dick.
I think the way they react says something about who they are, because on one hand, they're deeply self-aware and self-critical. But it also hurt their feelings. Talk about how they reacted.
Yeah, I mean, that John Perellis review came out very early in their career. And I found it because they were at a well taped show in Athens at the Uptown Lounge. And Amy, I think someone off stage said something like, how about the New York Times? And Amy and Emily just made a joke of it because I think back then people were really into music criticism, but Amy was like, you know what? We are pretentious and I am self-congratulatory, and we are bad poetry. And then Emily jokes, you know, yeah, we're just doing it for the money.
Right.
And that's how, and I'm like, what are they talking about? And I'm like, well, there must be something that they're talking about. And so I found the article and then presented to them the idea of reading it. And, you know, at first, you know, I asked them off camera, of course, first, before we got into it, if they would be down, and they said yes. And And then, you know, we're reminded of it when we're in an interview. And, you know, I just love their reaction to it because it's so many things that are relatable in there where you're just like believing the critic, but also really reflecting and recognizing the deep sexism and homophobia in that review. And also, you know, this is a time when James Taylor was doing really well. And it's like, okay, like that guy is incredibly similar kind of music that you could say the same things about, but you're not. You know, so I was really, really interested to get their reaction because I knew they would handle it and in such a fascinating way where it wasn't just like this black and white bad guy versus we're the good guys. And they wanted to talk about it and think about it and reflect on it. And they also laughed about it, but were also hurt. I mean, that scene used to be like 10 minutes long of gold. And I wish I could have put the whole thing in because it is absolutely just like side splitting hilarious in parts. So, but yeah, I'm really proud of that scene because I don't think I've seen anybody else do that in a music biopic.
I think we should also say that that where Emily and Amy are in their life, it's not this sort of no one's life is just this static thing where you get settled in. And one of the things that really seems kind of new and novel about the film is how they both talk about gender identity and sexuality in a much more nuanced and complicated way. Emily talks about how she only identified as queer over the last 5 years. Amy talks about gender dysphoria being, you know, split between male and female. Did you know this or did this part surprise you?
I found out both of these things while filming before the interview and wanted to talk to them about it. You know, Emily being attracted to men physically, but not romantically. I felt like that was such an important thing. And you know, these are queer icons and are people who helped, you know, countless amount of people come out or be okay with their queerness. And so, but I didn't want to leave that in the past as like these lesbians from the early 90s. You know, they are still, you know, obviously still very prolific with their music, but they're still exploring these ideas and are the kind of people that really learn from the younger generations and want to know more, and their curiosity is really admirable, and their openness to exploring that I think is a really important thing for the queer community to take away, because not everybody is open to that in the queer community. There's a lot of fear for this change, and especially when it comes to gender, you know, and also biphobia and bi-erasure. You know, I don't think there would have been space for Emily in, you know, previous decades to say that she was bi. There definitely would not have been space for that. And I don't think there would have been space for Amy to come out as trans, you know, so, or gender nonconforming, you know, so, and they, you know, grapple with that and are curious and interested. And I wanted that to be in the film because we're not meeting them as like only these one identities from the past. I mean, these are evolving people. So it comes back to, you know, our lives and how we change over time, and they're still changing, and we're all capable of change and growth and coming closer and closer to ourselves. And they're in their, you know, now 60s. So it's an incredible part of the conversation that I really hold near and dear to my heart.
What have you learned from them? Just like on a personal level, and how have you been influenced by meeting these two extraordinary people?
Well, I feel very You know, I'm also a very sensitive soul, and I think my films completely, every film I've made has completely changed my DNA and completely changed who I am. And this film is no different. I admire so much about Amy and Emily and these, you know, themes and concepts and questions and scenes that I was editing over a 2-year period. It took a long time to make this film, with all the archive and a pandemic and everything. But when you're sitting in a room for 8 hours a day, focusing on these ideas, you can't help but be shifted by them. And whether that's around queerness or community or activism, you know, it changes you. And I think a big one was also that I just hold such different priorities in my life now. And, you know, the theme, I would say that the, you know, every film you kind of typically have a thesis and an antithesis. And this film's antithesis was success is individualism. And so that every time there's like this individualism or what success is, like Amy's anger and, you know, feeling like she's a rock star and that reaction, or, you know, just coming away from community with Emily's alcoholism. And, but the thesis actually is success is being in right relationship with yourself and your community. And that's really where the film comes to, where they're really showing that right relationship by the end during a pandemic, where their priorities are very clear during a very heavy time in 2020. And, you know, for me, I am a classic documentary filmmaker workaholic, and not having great boundaries and forgetting to take care of myself and my community, it's completely shifted my life. I am very intertwined with my community now, and took years of work to do that, and I'm way better right relationship with myself and my community, and I'm grateful to them, but also to just the process of the film of bringing all these things up and focusing on them and having conversations with my two story consultants, Wes and Natalie, and with my producer and best friend, Brock, about this film and just our life and how it reflects in our own lives and just the beautiful conversations we were able to have. It's meant the world to me.
We know it, the question of how they, Amy and Emily, how they define success comes up. There's this interesting part of the film, the way you cut it, where there are these interviewers who ask them, how has success changed you? And questions like that. And they kind of ask each other, are we successful? That seems important, I guess.
Yeah, and I think Emily did it twice, kind of in a facetious way. She was joking. She's like, "Oh, are we successful now, Amy?" Because, you know, they've been a working band for a decade by that time. They had already been working in bars and everything for so long, and it was a massive difference when they got signed. But, you know, success. I put that stuff in the film because success for them is different than what you would think. I mean, if they had stuck to one genre, if they had dressed more feminine, if they had not come out as queer, would they have been more successful in the capitalist sense? Yeah. If they had not done activism, yeah, they would have been more successful. But they made choices to not do that, and they had consequences, but also it's like, I don't think they really had a choice, because they are two people that really are authentic to who they are. And that's just the way that they're going to be. And I think people relate to that in the music and really admire that. So, Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to look at as a musician, but also as an artist, and what you're doing with your life and what choices you're making with your work.
Alexandria Bombach, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was a wonderful conversation.
It's Alexandria Bombach. The film is called Indigo Girls, It's Only Life After All, which we're going to be screening on Saturday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. You can get more information on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on YouTube, KUER 90.1, and Instagram at Radio West. You can also email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Stevie Shaughnessy is our intern. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.